I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about the just-begun 2014 session of the Indiana General Assembly. We're going to talk about what's likely to happen and what's not likely to happen. We'll talk about same-sex marriage, taxes, education, and, of course, politics. I'll be joined by my colleagues, Leslie Weidenbender of thestatehousefile.com, Chelsea Schneider of the Evansville Courier and Press, and Eric Bradner of Politico. Please join the conversation by calling 1-866-476-3881, emailing nolimits@wfyi.org, finding us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news.
Support is provided by WGU Indiana, Indiana's 8th state university. Information about earning a degree from WGU, an accredited online nonprofit university, is available at indiana.wgu.edu. And by Apparatus, supporting Big Brothers Big Sisters of Central Indiana during National Mentoring Month in January. More on how to become a Big Brother Big Sister or be a part of a big couple at bebigforkids.org.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking about the 2014 Indiana legislature today. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are three colleagues and actually good friends. One of them works with me, and the other two are former students of mine, so I should get that out front. Joining me here in the studio is my colleague, Leslie Stedman Weidenbender, who is the executive editor for thestatehousefile.com. Leslie, welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much for having me, John.
And joining me on the phone right now with Politico is Eric Bradner. Eric, how are you guys? How are you doing?
Hey, thanks for having me, John. Good
sure.
to hear.
Sure. It's good to have you here as well. I should say these are familiar voices for our listeners because they both guest hosted this program at different times. We may also be joined by Chelsea Schneider, who is the State House Bureau Chief of the Evansville Courier and Press. Well, Leslie, it's a crowded day at the legislature today. Can you tell me a little bit about what's going on, particularly what's going on? I think we probably ought to talk about the elephant in the parlor, which is the whole same-sex marriage debate. What's going on there?
Sure. Well, we've been waiting for the House Republicans to decide how they're going to handle the marriage debate. I think we got a little bit more information today, and frankly, I think it's a little bit confusing. The constitutional amendment was read across the desk today. Basically, that means it was introduced. But along with that, a bill was introduced. It's House Bill 1153. Now, that in and of itself is not unusual. There's always a companion bill with a constitutional amendment that lays out the specifics of how an amendment, if passed, would be placed on the ballot. But this one goes a little further. It goes into some detail about what is meant by the amendment. And I won't go into all the specifics here, but essentially what Republicans are trying to do with this bill is to say that a number of questions that have been raised about the amendment would not apply. Things like that it says that the amendment would not prevent private companies from offering same-sex benefits. It wouldn't affect domestic violence laws. It goes through a litany of things like that. But it still seems to me that the underlying constitutional amendment would stay the same, which means it would define marriage as the union of a man and a woman, and it would ban civil union.
And it correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't interpreting what the amendment would say sort of the court's job and not necessarily the legislature's?
It's not unprecedented for the companion bill to have some explanation in it, I think. But I think this is somewhat unusual, the extent to which that this tries to explain it. And, you know, the truth is that no state law trumps a constitutional amendment. And so if the constitutional amendment were put in place, I would not be at all surprised if some of these issues ended up in the courts.
Eric, put this, if you could, in some context. I mean, how much of this is a product of the fact that Indiana is kind of a focal point for what is a national debate right now about same-sex marriage?
Sure. You know, Indiana got off the hot seat a little bit when a judge ruled that Utah's constitutional same-sex marriage ban is illegal. And it looks like that case could eventually wind up at the U.S. Supreme Court and could determine whether states have the right to ban same-sex marriage generally. But Indiana is definitely the battleground here in the upcoming election season. Indiana is the only state that is actually trying to ban same-sex marriage at this point and add that ban to the Constitution. All other states have either already done that or they're working to unwind that and actually allow gay marriage. So this is something that, you know, I think it's fair to say that this is going to be a battle that gets a lot of national attention in large part because this is where opponents of the ban can really take a stand. This is where they can say, look, even in blood red Indiana, the tide is changing. This is so that's why you're going to see a ton of money get poured into this if the legislature does end up putting the ban on the ballot, and why it's going to get a ton of attention.
How much money are we talking about? I mean, I know Freedom Indiana, we had a show on same-sex marriage just a couple of weeks ago, and it replayed this past Tuesday, and they were talking about raising $15 million just all by themselves. How much are we talking about?
I think $15 million is the basement for what they'll raise. I think they'll raise much more than that. I think this will be more expensive than any governor's race Indiana has ever seen. Right now, you know, the Lugar-Murdoch U.S. Senate primary was, I think, a $50 million affair. I think this would be certainly close to that if it doesn't exceed it.
And I think it's not going to be completely one-sided. I would expect that the opponents of the amendment, which would be those folks who support same-sex marriage, those folks will probably spend the most. But Advance America, which is an organization based here in Indiana that is socially conservative and an opponent of gay marriage. That group started some ads just yesterday, actually. And so it's not going to just be one-sided. And there have been some other targeted newspaper advertising by groups in places where Republicans seem to be wavering on the issue.
You mentioned the term Republicans are wavering. I know the Star has reported that, saying that they're seeing some cracks. It's important to emphasize this moved with really, really strong support just a couple of years ago.
Yeah, not just Republicans either, but yeah, quite a few Democrats as well.
And that seems to be shifting somewhat. Eric, what's brought about the change?
Well, a senator from Ohio named Rob Portman recently, and he's a Republican, former Bush administration official who supports same-sex marriage rights, recently called it a threshold issue for young voters, right, which means that people under 30, under 35, under 40 will not even consider a candidate who doesn't support same-sex marriage rights. They don't care about other positions. They're willing to give that candidate a fair hearing regardless of party. But only if they get past that threshold issue. It's sort of a human rights, a civil rights thing to them. And so that's brought about a big portion of the change. I mean, if you look at the polling nationally and in Indiana, it's very clear that as it's sort of becoming more acceptable to talk about being gay, for people to come out, and as young voters who are much more accepting of this grow up and become eligible to vote, the tide is definitely changing. So it's a lot of factors, and part of this is also that you're seeing Republicans nationally get focused a lot more on fiscal issues. They're sort of saying, like, all right, let's put these. It's sort of the truth that Mitch Daniels called for. They're saying, let's put a lot of these social issues on the back burner and focus on what to them is the top priority, which is spending. And they're not interested in imperiling their ability to tackle some of those issues by getting bogged down in social fights. And yet, in Indiana, that's exactly what's happening. This is something that I think that Republican legislative leadership right now is really underestimating, in terms of how big a fight this is going to be, in terms of what it's going to mean for their legacies. I think it's fair to say that young voters certainly view this as the most important thing that anyone currently elected to the Indiana General Assembly has ever dealt with.
How much of this, Leslie, is, and I should say to our listeners, if you'd like to join the conversation, please look for our contact information on our website. You also can call in at 1-866-476-3881. How much of this, Eric's making the case that there's a generational thing going on here, and the studies do show that. But here in Indiana, it's also created some problems in terms of the traditional Republican coalition, and that a lot of the business community has come out against. How much does that play a role?
It does play a role. I mean, I do think that in the end, this is one of these issues that comes down to what constituents want. I think in the end, that is the most important thing. I think a lawmaker generally is going to vote with the way their district is riding. And Eric's right, in Indiana, polls show that the tide has been turning, that more and more people are accepting of same-sex marriage, or at the very least, what they really are unsure about is whether they want to put this into the Constitution. But the Republicans
tie their hands.
That's right. Tie the hands of future legislators, you know, to a large degree. I mean, it's not set in stone at that point, but to a large degree. But what businesses, who do traditionally support Republicans, but what a lot of big businesses, and we're talking about important Indiana businesses like Eli Lilly and Cummins, and there are a lot of others, even the Indianapolis Chamber of Commerce, has come out against the amendment. They are concerned about these younger folks that Eric talked about. They're concerned about being able to retain workers, attract workers to Indiana. They are concerned that this will put them in a difficult spot when it comes to competing with companies in other places.
And is that, you know, when we talked about the companion bill here to it, I mean, to my ears, that reads to some degree like they're trying to split the baby here.
Yeah, well, I mean, I do think this companion bill attempts to address some of the issues that businesses say that they have concerns about, and one of them is their own ability to extend benefits to same-sex couples. But in the end, I think that while that is one of the issues that businesses have raised, I don't think that this bill will satisfy businesses. I think they will still, the ones we're talking about, the big companies that are competing for talent with other firms all over the world, I think they will still find this unacceptable.
And Eric, I know you cover trade for Politico. I mean, will this be, are those business concerns legitimate? Are they valid? Is it likely to be a deterrent to getting companies to relocate, or having companies that are here, will it inhibit their ability to recruit talent?
I think the answer is definitely yes. This is, you know, part of Indiana's climate. It's part of what determines whether, you know, the state is a place that a business that's looking to move is some place that their executives want to spend time. It's you know, not going to be the driving factor, especially because there are a number of other states that still do have constitutional bans. On the other hand, it's certainly something that would be considered.
We are talking about the upcoming session of the Indiana General Assembly here on, not upcoming, it just begun, here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Rhonda, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoy this program every week.
Thank you.
I just wanted to call today because I wanted to touch on something that Eric said about same-sex marriage ban possibly being generational. I truly kind of believe that to be the case. I am a mother, and my children do not define their peers by their looks or their sexual preference. And sometimes I get frustrated that we're considering dumping a lot of money into politics to get a ban in place. But quite honestly, when my children are adults in 10, 15 years, they might very well just turn it over and that money be gone. I'd rather see us focus our financial efforts to things that are really going to matter, like the education system in the state of Indiana.
Thank you very much for the call and the comment, Rhonda, and thank you for listening.
Yeah. And you're welcome. Can I respond to some of that if you don't
sure,
mind?
Sure, please.
So a couple of important points here. One, she talks about her children and the impact that they've had on sort of the way she thinks of things. David Long, the Senate president in Indiana, a Republican Senate president, has said that his children are lobbying him on this too. So, I mean, that's something that that a lot of people who are involved in this debate are going to be feeling. But it also goes to the
Eric, can you hold that thought for just a second? We'll catch it on the other side of the break. We are talking about the 2014 session of the Indiana General Assembly. I'm talking right now with Leslie Stedman Weidenbender and Eric Bradner. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking about the 2014 legislature. My guests are Leslie Stedman Weidenbender, who is the executive editor of StateHouseFile.com, and Eric Bradner, who is with Politico. Eric, just before we went to the break, you were responding to Rhonda's points about the generational shift and also the fact that this debate is going to be very personal in some cases.
What I wanted to say is that debates like this get big, and by that I mean people talk about the top lines, right? The broad issues, the generational issues here, and so that's something that that is going to impact the way that the companion bill that was introduced today is received. This is something where this is a debate where you can't really get into the weeds that much. That companion bill is going to do nothing to alter the debate because it doesn't change the nature of this really emotional, really high-profile debate that's happening. And it's kind of confusing, to be honest, to watch Republican legislative leaders try to advance that tactic because, I mean, Brian Bosma, the Speaker of the House, and David Long, the Senate President, are shrewd politicians. Mm-hmm. These are guys who you know, really have their fingers on the pulses of their caucuses. And it's strange to see them trying to use the phrase split the baby, and I think that's what they're trying to do. But this is a level of nuance that is going to be lost in the broader debate.
Is there? I remember when we did the show on same-sex marriage, and I'm going to pose this question to both of you. You know, I asked Kurt Smith, who's one of the leaders in the fight to get the ban pushed through, with the Indiana Family Institute, and Zach Adamson, who's a council member here in Indianapolis, and recently married his partner. If there was any sort of level of compromise here, any way to solve this thing that would address both of their concerns, and they both pretty much said no, which tells me that, you know, there's not a whole lot of ground here to run around, and there's not a whole lot of middle ground here, I guess I would say, to find. People are going to have to take sides. Leslie, is that your impression?
I think that's certainly true today. A few years ago, I'm not sure what's sort of interesting about this companion bill is that it addresses issues that were the most prominent 3 or 4 years ago, 2 to 4 years ago. So there was a time in which opponents weren't making a lot of headway by arguing simply that same-sex marriage was okay. Mm-hmm. There was a time when that didn't go over very well in Indiana. So the things they tended to argue about were, is this going to hurt private businesses' ability to offer same-sex benefits? Is this going to hurt our domestic violence laws? These issues that are addressed in this companion bill are the things people were using against this constitutional amendment a few years ago. The truth is now people are far less concerned about just coming out and saying, I think it's a bad idea. And so I agree with Eric to some degree that especially in terms of the public, I don't think that this companion bill serves as any sort of compromise at all. I do think for some legislators, it amounts to some cover, or they believe that it will be some cover in terms of things that concerns that have been raised.
So I'll ask the question, and then I want to pick up on something else Rhonda said and move on to other subjects. Does this does it move out of the General Assembly and go onto the ballot?
I just don't know. I frankly just don't have a sense of that yet. I honestly thought a few months ago that we would see more Republicans who were opposed to it, but not as many have shaken out as I thought we would see. In fact, in the Star story the other day, there weren't actually a lot of named Republicans who had come forward to say they had changed their mind. So I'm not clear about that yet.
The Star story really just sort of recapped news that had leaked out over about a year. I mean, these are all names that everyone already knew would oppose the amendment. So, yeah, I think there are a lot of Republicans right now who are torn between really wanting to vote no, wanting to have nothing to do with this anymore, wanting to just get rid of the debate, and a fear that if they do that, they would face primaries, whether those are driven by social conservatives like Eric Miller's group, Advance America, or Tea Partiers who across the country actually are taking sort of a more libertarian approach. Yet in Indiana, some groups are definitely trying to advance socially conservative causes. So I think there are a lot of Republicans who are just trying to figure out right now what's the riskier move. And, I don't really have a feel for whether it's going to pass or not. I guess if I was to bet on something, I would say that the second sentence dealing with civil unions and everything else will probably be amended out, which at least delays the debate until 2016, if it doesn't end it outright. But it's hard to say at this point.
I do think it's important to point out that we've made kind of a big deal about the way the polls have changed, and it's been dramatic. In all the issues that I've ever covered, I've never seen the public sentiment shift as much as it has as it has in this debate. But I do think most of those same polls show that Republicans, if you looked at the Republican primary voters, a lot of those folks still think that this amendment is a good idea, or at least they're willing to vote for it or not hold a vote for it against a candidate. So we have Republican majorities in the House and Senate. They are, to a large degree, looking at a different constituency than necessarily looking at the whole state. So it is not surprising that this issue has been very difficult for a number of Republicans.
And Eric alluded.
And one final point to consider is that you've got to think about legislative leaders or even younger members of the legislature, what they want to do in the future, whether they see themselves as statewide candidates at some point or see themselves leading a caucus. If they do, then they have to know that this issue is a few years away from becoming a real albatross. It's something that could really affect the future of a young politician, someone who's older, someone who's in an established district and doesn't really want to run statewide or anything like that, can probably vote however he or she wants.
We probably ought to explain the second sentence and the amendment itself is only two sentences long. If it gets amended, given Indiana's constitutional amendment process, that means, in effect, the clock starts over.
That's right, certainly Leslie? The argument that made by a lot of folks. There are some people who don't believe that. And House Speaker Brian Bosma has pointed to some precedent that some people would argue would allow just the section that has been passed twice to go forward. Senate President Pro Tem David Long has raised questions about that and says he's not sure that's the case. It certainly, if they tried to go forward with the amendment after it had been amended, it would end up in court.
Yeah, count on a lawsuit on that. The other thing that Rhonda alluded to is the other huge controversy in Indiana right now, that same-sex marriage and the money that's going to go into it is going to divert attention from education, which is her priority with children. And we've got an educational structure, a board of education that seems to be at war with the state superintendent of public instruction and the governor, weighing in with the board, and yet another body that assumes some of those roles. Leslie, could you give us an overview on where that is right now?
Well, things seem to have eased up just a tad. I wouldn't count on them having eased up considerably. It could just be a temporary truce. But we have a Democrat, Glenda Ritz, who is the superintendent of public instruction now. She last, I guess, actually in 2012, defeated a kind of a Republican darling in Tony Bennett. So she won that race, and she won it relatively handily. And then we have, of course, a Republican governor in Mike Pence, who and governors appoint the members of the State Board of Education. Glenda Ritz is the chairwoman of the State Board of Education. And those folks over the past year have not been getting along. And they have, you know, several board meetings and several debates have come to a screeching halt as a result of that divisive nature. And since then, Mike Pence has created what some people say is almost like a second education department. And so there's just a lot of division in those two, between those two offices and in the education world right now. Lawmakers have to figure out whether they want to dip into that at all. And that's a big question for them.
What are the Board of Education? I guess I'm not even going to try to walk through the roster again. We've only got so much time in this hour. But Eric, what are they fighting about? I mean, what's at stake here?
Well, it's really a turf war in a lot of ways. They're fighting about, there are a lot of specific things that they're fighting about, but it's kind of all a proxy for a lot of anger and frustration over the fact that they really liked Tony Bennett, the Republican former state superintendent, and they're really angry that Glenda Ritz, the Democratic replacement, is doing just about everything she can to stymie, unwind, block, et cetera, a lot of Tony Bennett's initiatives. Leslie can talk a lot more about the specifics, but in a lot of ways, it's just a turf war. It's just about, whether Ritz is doing what this rather powerful board wants her to do. And it's the byproduct of a state that separately elects, a governor who gets to appoint members to this education policy setting body, and a state superintendent who is charged with implementing those regulations, and who I think most voters see as an education policy leader, even though that's only the case in practice when the State Board of Education agrees with that superintendent.
Yeah, we're talking about the 2014 legislative session here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. How much of this is really about, Leslie, who's gonna drive education policy in the state?
Well, that's really what it's all about. Although I think both sides would tell you that along the way they've taken a few steps that have just exacerbated the situation and made it become about really silly little things like who can put an item on the State Board of Education agenda. Having said that, though, in the end, it is all about power and setting the policy. And, you know, Eric laid out what the situation is and how complicated it is. And then you have to add in the layer of the General Assembly, which sets kind of overall education policy that the board and the superintendent then implement. The legislature, they don't keep their hands out of education. I mean, mm-hmm. A perfect example is that a few years ago, the State Board of Education adopted what are called the Common Core standards. So Common Core is a set of curriculum standards that was established by a group of state leaders, but then later it was adopted by President Barack Obama's administration. And now a lot of states are backing off, and Indiana is one where they don't like the idea that the federal government, particularly a Democratic president, has endorsed standards that would be used in Indiana. And so now you're going to see the legislature backing off those and probably ordering the state board to come up with a set of standards that would be all Indiana.
Is there some pressure, political pressure, Leslie, for the lawmakers to step in, legislative leaders in particular, given that part of what really kicked this into overdrive was the State Board of Education sent the legislative leaders a letter saying, in effect, would you come in and take over?
You know, we have a lot of things going on. So in this power struggle, I actually think legislative leaders have been trying to work very quietly behind the scenes to be mediators in this debate between the board and the superintendent. I actually think they don't want to get very involved in that. Having said that, there are some really huge education issues, curriculum standards being just one of them, that are facing the state, and lawmakers do want to be involved in that, and especially Republicans. They are hearing from a lot of their more conservative constituents that they don't like Common Core, they don't like national input in standards, they don't like some of the textbooks and materials that have been created around Common Core, and there is a loud outcry. I don't know how big it really is. I'm not sure most parents are sitting around talking about the term Common Core, but the folks who are upset about it are really upset about it, and they're making a lot of noise.
Eric, in terms of this battle, it has struck me at times that, you know, in terms of the way that the governor has handled it and the Board of Education, that they've actually helped to elevate Glenda Ritz's profile. Is that the case?
That's absolutely right. I think so. I think one of the really smart moves that Glenda Ritz made was to insist on meeting with Mike Pence, and in doing so, sort of put herself on the same level as Mike Pence. When, you know, in reality, one's the governor and one's not. And you know, if you look at the way people have been acting throughout all this drama, and consider that politicians often do what's best for them, regardless of common purpose and common good. A lot of Glenda Ritz's moves start to make sense. I mean, Republican legislators are clearly frustrated and are a bit frustrated with all sides involved, and so they've tried to act as mediators. Yet Glenda Ritz doesn't really need a mediator. In order to satisfy the voters who elected her, the best thing she can do is obstruct at every step of the way, and that's just reality. That's the political reality. That's what voters elected her to do. It was a race that was a referendum on the education reforms Tony Bennett and Mitch Daniels had pursued. And so, you know, but that reality just makes everyone involved even more frustrated. But yeah, it's become a situation where I think people are really seeing it as Ritz versus Pence and Pence's proxies on the State Board of Education. And in reality, the governor does appoint the State Board, so that's what it is.
Leslie, you mentioned the fact that the lawmakers are trying to mediate this. Is there any, again, I'll ask the same sort of question I did on the same, is there any kind of common ground here, any place where they seem to be able to work together?
I think that they will start working together better. While I understand where Eric's coming from about how some of the moves Glenda Ritz has made may make some sense, but at the same time, I think in the end, no side looks good in this. I don't think the general public spends a lot of time trying to figure out who's right and wrong. I think they all have looked silly at times, and I don't think that's good for any of them. And I think they are coming to realize that unless they start to work together a little bit more, none of them will be very effective.
Are there any, like, issues? I mean, there are some big divides. I mean, Ritz opposes vouchers, and that Board of Education supports the idea. Are there places where they seem to be finding policy-driven places where they seem to be working together?
Well, I think the truth is that no Republicans and Democrats, none of them really like the A to F grading system that was in place, that's in place right now. There seems to be a lot of agreement that some of those things need to change. Now, they don't agree on all the details, but they actually seem to be on the same page on quite a few things. And, you know, that A to F grading system is a big part of what's going on, and the accountability standards and testing that determine those grades. And I actually think there is some common ground they can find.
We are talking about the 2014 legislative session. The Indiana General Assembly is back. My guests are Leslie Stedman Weidenbender of the StateHouseFile.com, executive editor there, and Eric Bradner, who is with Politico. If you would like to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Again, we're talking about the 2014 legislative session. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Mm-hmm. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking about the 2014 Indiana General Assembly session. My guests are Leslie Stedman Weidenbender, the executive editor of the State House File, and Eric Bradner with Politico. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Greg, welcome to the program. Well, we'll try back with Greg a little later. We've also gotten a tweet from a listener who says, "Too bad you're still passing bill banning gay marriage. Makes us an unfriendly state to diversity." Eric, what signal, if this does go through, I mean, either way, I should say, what are the likely outcomes in terms of how Indiana is perceived in other parts of the country, assuming, you know, the ban goes into the Constitution and assuming that it doesn't?
Sure. Well, assuming that the ban does go into the Constitution, the reality is Indiana is more conservative than the country overall. It will be viewed as a step backwards in terms of civil rights nationally. That's just the reality. There are arguments that religious groups might make to counter that, but more broadly, the majority of people on the national stage will see it as a red state, trying to get redder on an issue that is trending the other way. If Indiana rejects the ban, that would be momentous. That would be a sign to advocates of same-sex marriage rights that they can win these battles even in very conservative states, and it would be perhaps seen as a beginning of a trend of fighting to have some of the states that have already implemented these bans, to have those reversed on the political level rather than solely in the courts, as we've seen in Utah. And that would be really interesting. That would be that's a big part of why Indiana is so important in terms of sort of the next steps of this national debate.
And you mentioned the fact that in Utah there's a court case. Obviously, U.S. Supreme Court ruled on same-sex marriage last summer,
mm-hmm.
And it was kind of interesting because that created almost as much confusion as it resolved.
It did. You know, the thing that the court didn't address is whether states have the right to ban same-sex marriage. And that's what the Utah case is about. The Supreme Court did sort of clarify some things with the federal government, but in California, too, but left state constitutional bans and state laws banning same-sex marriage completely untouched. And so the question is, was the court's ruling last year sort of a big step toward doing that, or will the court come back on the other side and say, you know, no, we're not going to intervene in states' affairs like that?
And what is the timetable on the Utah? Would probably not something this year, I would guess, but is next year a likelihood?
I'd say probably yes. It's a little early to tell at this point. This is something that's just developing over the last few weeks, and as you know, court cases can take quite a while to wind their way through. But it sounds like the Supreme Court is ultimately going to end up taking this up at some point in the next couple of years.
And Leslie, does that create another set of pressures for legislators? Because last year at this time, that was one of the reasons they said they weren't going to take up the constitutional amendment. They're obligated to do it in one of these two sessions.
I was going to say it was pretty easy to do last year because they knew they could come back and do the amendment this year, and it really didn't make any difference. At this point, I mean, any delay, as Eric said, starts this process all over again. I do think they just feel pressure from all sides. They're feeling pressure from voters and political pressure and from businesses. I mean, there's frankly no end to the pressure from both sides. that lawmakers are feeling about this, and that's why it's such a difficult issue. If there's ever been an issue where people contacting their lawmaker to say how they feel about it could make a real difference, this could be the one.
And we've talked about how high profile this is. It's almost as if that dominates everything that's going on, but there is other business.
Interesting and very important issues going on at the legislature.
So walk us through some of those.
I want to talk about just two predominantly at the moment. One of them has to do with what's called the business personal property tax, which is just a fancy way of saying a property tax on the equipment that any kind of company uses to develop its product. So that could be a photographer. It could be the photographer's camera. It could be a plant, the equipment that a plant uses to put together a car. So it can range from the small things to the big things. And this is a tax that is not levied by the state. It's levied by local governments and schools. And it raises $1 billion statewide. So it's a huge amount of money. And the governor and some Republicans have decided that it's time to get rid of it. The Indiana Chamber of Commerce has said for years that the tax is onerous and that it prevents companies from coming to Indiana. It's important to note that Indiana has a very business-friendly tax climate. But some Republicans are convinced that this is one of those check-off items, that if a company sees that you have a personal property tax, they won't even consider coming to the state. So the governor is proposing to phase that tax out, but he's not saying anything about how to replace the revenue or if it would even have to be replaced at all in his mind. And now the House and Senate have both come out with their own ideas about how to reduce the tax to some degree, I think with an eye toward eliminating it down the road. That is an enormous issue. It's a big issue for local governments and schools, and it's a big issue for businesses. So we should watch for that one.
Okay.
And then there's the second one I wanted to mention is a state-funded preschool. The governor says it's time for the state to provide preschool to low-income kids. He wants to do it by essentially expanding the voucher program, and some House Republicans are on board with that. There's a lot of concern, I think, in the Senate that this is a program that's just too expensive, and certainly that is an issue anytime, we're still recovering in a lot of ways, despite Indiana's solid financial condition. We're still recovering in a lot of ways from the recession, and some folks are concerned that we might have a double dip, and this is not a time to be implementing a big program like that.
We are talking about the 2014 session of the Indiana General Assembly. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits at WFYI.org, or you can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or on Twitter at WFYI. Richard, welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I had a question actually on the business personal property tax, and it's actually something I've been trying to pay a lot of attention to. And I was just wondering why it seems like when businesses want to get a break to, create more jobs, it ends up stuff like that turns around and ends up on the back of the people working for the business in forms of higher income tax rates and everything else, and why an elected official would think this is a good policy to have to tax its electorate even higher.
Yeah,
thanks very much for the call and the question, Richard.
There's no doubt that in the past, these kinds of tax cuts have often been shifted over to things like the local option income tax. When the legislature worked on a phase out a few years ago of, I think it's actually been like 15 years now, of the inventory tax, which was a property tax on products that companies had sitting around, maybe in a warehouse. When they eliminated that, they gave counties the option of increasing the local option income tax, which a lot of them took advantage of. And so, yes, there have been shifts over the years from business to individuals. Now, it's not clear that that would be the case here. That is sort of the first option that everyone talks about. And if that option came to be, it would be a big income tax increase for across the state. And it would be especially large in those counties that are more industrial. But there, Senator Luke Kenly, who runs the Appropriations Committee, has said several times that he is not in favor of a total shift over to individuals. He thinks that a business tax should replace the personal property tax. And so there are folks who are talking about that concern. I don't think that this discussion will take place without a huge emphasis on that issue.
One of the things Mike Pence might point out is that last year he advocated for an individual income tax cut, which actually does go to regular people rather than to businesses. On the other hand, he didn't get nearly what he wanted in that battle. He got about half the tax cut over like three times as long. And I think in this case you're going to see something similar. The governor's proposed a tax cut that, frankly, legislators weren't really on board with before he pitched the idea, and that they're going to be getting a lot of pressure from local government officials in both parties to offset somehow. And so I don't think that what the governor has proposed here in the form that he proposed it stands much of a chance of becoming law. So, the details are going to be fascinating as it works its way through the legislative process.
And Eric, well, while you were talking about that, some of this, and I'll ask both of you, how much of this is also the fact that lawmakers don't yet have complete confidence in our revenue projections going forward? Leslie, you're nodding your head, so I'm going to go to you.
Well, that's a huge concern. So every 6 months, sometimes every year, it depends on the cycle that we're in, the legislators get an update on the state's fiscal condition and projections about how much tax revenue will be coming in. We just had one of those in December, and it showed that the state wouldn't be taking in probably as much revenue as expected when this current state budget passed. I think that's just a signal of the larger concerns about the economy. We're quite a few years actually away from the last recession. It's been a long, slow recovery. But we're actually pretty far from it. And so we're getting near the time when history would tell us that there could be another recession, another dip. That's a big concern.
How much of that is the fact that it's sort of been an uneven recovery, too?
It really has been. We still have a relatively high job
and all of that.
And we have a relatively high jobless rate in relation to where it was before all of this happened. I'm not sure historically it's that big. But, there's just a lot of uncertainty in the economy right now. And then in Indiana, we have some other issues that are of concern. The state has been for a while now using gambling revenue in its general budget. That gambling revenue is being eaten away by competition in Ohio from new casinos. And then we've got a tobacco settlement issue that is going to take $63 million out of the state budget next year, which doesn't sound like much, but there's a potential for that to just keep on going. And so there's a lot of uncertainty.
Debbie, welcome to the program.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
I'm calling in relationship to a bill, House Bill 1032. The bill, Jerry Tor is the person who authored it. I think there are some co-authors with it as well. I'm not sure who else. It is a bill that is calling for a legislative-appointed redistricting commission, which would help move the redistricting process away from it being totally a partisan process into more of a bipartisan process. That bill actually was able to pass the Elections Committee, so it needs to go through the full House and then go to the Senate. But I was just wondering what your panelists thought about the possibility of this type of bill being able to get past the House and perhaps past the Senate. I think there's going to be some amendments that will be added to it, and it'll be changed somewhat, but it seems to be moving along a little, and I just wondered what they might think about that.
Thanks very much for the call, Debbie. Well, Leslie, I'll start with you.
This is an issue that House Republicans have been pushing for a while. It did pass out of the Elections Committee, I guess, last night, really, or yesterday afternoon. There are a lot of questions about it. And in fact, I think there was a little bit of confusion about how all that would work. It's important to point out that right as things stand right now, even if a commission like this passed, legislators would still ultimately vote on these legislative districts. I know one of the other issues that was brought up about that bill is that there would still have to be, uh, it would the commission, which would be made up of Republicans and Democrats, would not have to have a unanimous vote. It would only have to have a majority vote, which raises questions about it, whether it could still be political. It's hard to take the politics out of redistricting.
Well, and
a lot of states have tried.
In general.
Yeah, a lot of states have tried. This is another attempt, and I do think it has some chance of moving through the process, especially with Republicans in control.
We've also gotten a Facebook question about the ag gag bill.
Oh, yeah, the ag gag bill. So I know the farmers just hate when we use that term, and so we should probably be a little bit careful about that. So this bill is all about farmers.
Labor hated right to work.
That's true.
Too,
so. Farmers, particularly livestock farmers, have concerns about folks who come onto their property or who pose as employees or try to get on as an employee and then surreptitiously take photos and video and you put them on YouTube to show the process that's used to slaughter animals in the food chain. So the farmers want to make that kind of a activity illegal. It runs into all kinds of questions about constitutional freedom of the press or freedom of speech issues and how much of that kind of thing can really be regulated. This bill was highly controversial last year, and it is controversial again this year. I do expect something to move, but there are a lot of lawyers involved in this legislation, and they all do not agree on what it does or what it says or what it should be. So it will be a very complicated thing to figure out.
Erica,
and it's worth pointing out that you know, when you use the term farmers, you think of like, you know, mom and pop, you know, running a 150-acre farm or something like that, when really this is something that's all about really big farms, and it's driven by the Farm Bureau and powerful lobbying forces. It's not like it's not about family farms really. I mean, it would extend to them, but those aren't the forces driving this.
Real quick, let me give each of you what's going to be the biggest surprise that comes out of this legislative session. Got about 10 seconds apiece.
I think the biggest surprise for me is going to be whatever happens with the marriage amendment. I think either way, I'll be surprised with what happens.
Eric, about 10 seconds.
Yeah, I think it's, I think the marriage amendment will fail somehow. The surprise will be how.
Well, thank you both very much, Leslie. Thank you for joining us on what is a very busy day at the General Assembly and the State House.
Thank you for having me, John.
And Eric, thank you very much for dialing in. I really appreciate it.
Good to talk to you both.
We will be back next week, and I would like to say to all of our listeners, thank you for joining us. Thank you for hanging in there. I hope you will all stay warm and safe through the weekend. Be careful out there. It is still dangerous. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Sharon Alseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Jeanette Rhodes. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.